These folks. Hello, hello. Hi. Hi, everybody. Can you eat a little bit quieter, please? Thank you. We're going to get started with our lunchtime presentation. I'm going to introduce the moderator for that, Rick Weiss, who's the director of Sci-Line.
If the mic won't come to you, then you could go to the mic. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this session that I think is going to be pretty lively and interesting, given the guests that we have with us today. I'll just mention first, as we do introductions, that you should all know what Sci-Line is. Here's my 30-second plug. Philanthropically funded free service for reporters. If you don't already use us, you should check it out at sci-line.org. We put you in touch with the best experts to do... We put you in touch with experts to help you with your stories on deadline. I want to introduce my two panelists that I'll be moderating with today, Michael Mann, climate scientist, Kathleen Hall Jameson, scholar of history, science, communication. The two of them co-teach climate communication here at Penn, and I think need no further introduction than that, and you'll get to know them a little bit through our conversation today. And I want to say one thing about moderating these two characters. I mean, this is like a job that nobody should take, believe me. First of all, they don't need any prompts to start talking. And second of all, the prospect of trying to stop them from talking is, you know, pretty daunting. But I took the job just for fun. And why don't I, you know, start off by mentioning one other kind of obvious truth, which is that over the past 10 years or so in this country, I'd say American society's relationship to truth has really evolved, or maybe devolved, a lot. There's, you know, this recognition, I think, that's come out of this, that a lot of what was holding our society together was not so much enforceable rules and regulations, but sort of soft agreements with each other about how we would behave. And if people decided to start breaking those rules and just lie and keep lying, then actually there was not a lot of punishment for them and they could get away with it. And it started making us realize, I think, how little was holding us together. Lying and propaganda are not new, but in this era when we have technology in our pockets that allow us to broadcast things intentionally or unintentionally to millions of people all at once, it starts to make a big difference. And as AI gets into the equation, which itself has no allegiance to truth and actually seems to be getting good at dissembling on its own, the equation has really changed quite a bit. So I want to talk about this crisis of information disinformation with regard to two areas, science and journalism, and those are the two areas that I think our guests here today can help us dig into a lot. Before we get into that, Kathleen, I wanted to start with you because your scholarship has taken sort of a historical look at some of this, and I wonder if you could talk for a few minutes about what happens in a society when the sort of cohesion of everyone having a basic agreement about what's true and what's not true and what's real and not real. What happens when those rules start to break down in society? What happens to democracy? What is the sort of situation we're in generally before we start talking specifically about science and journalism per se?
Yeah, once one moves from Daniel Patrick Moynihan's position, which is you're entitled to your own opinions, not your own facts, to assume that your own opinions are your own facts, the ability to find the common ground that lets people engage in constructive deliberation across differences to find compromise is eroded, and with it some of the premises of how democratic systems work. But in that environment, knowledge still does matter. If you look at the QR code on the screen, you'll see a link to a survey that we've done that shows that there are 12 statements about science and science communication of climate that predict through to individual behaviors that are science consistent about climate, and also they predict through to support for climate consistent policies. So even in the face of an environment in which increasingly we polarize just about everything, knowledge still matters. Unfortunately, the corollary is so does misinformation.
Michael, do you want to talk more generally before we get into science per se? What do you feel around you in the universe of truth? We'll talk about your case second in a minute, but more generally, what's your feeling about what's going on in the world?
Yeah, as I like to tell my colleagues in the public health arena these days, we in the climate arena, we're dealing with misinformation and disinformation and alternative facts decades before it became fashionable. We sort of saw this coming, and so it's been horrifying in some ways to see what was once sort of this localized infection when it came to the public discourse over climate sort of infect our entire body politic today. And it's really some of the same bad actors who benefit from misinformation about climate change who also benefit from division and distraction and who have recognized that they can use these tools to sort of go, you know, attack democratic governance itself. It's a very scary place to be because there is no path to climate progress, to meaningful action on climate, in my view, that does not go through a healthy, functioning democracy here in the U.S. and abroad.
Hmm. So let's get into science itself. Science is an institution where, you know, hewing to the truth is what it's all about, right? Science is about finding the truth and expressing the truth. It takes a lot of pride in that fact. Science, of course, doesn't always argue that it's right. In fact, one of the beauties of science is that it admits that it doesn't know completely whether it's right and that it tries to be pretty explicit about the degree of uncertainty surrounding the things that it discovers and proclaims. But today there are, as we started to talk about here, political forces at work that are trying to not just do old-fashioned sow doubt about science, I'd say going further and actually claiming scientific findings and scientists themselves to be fraudulent and frauds. No one knows this better than Michael Mann, who fought for more than a decade over being told that his science was fraudulent and that he was a fraud. And I think it would be helpful, Michael, for you to do a, probably not an entire amicus brief, but talk a little bit about your case. And what I'd really be interested in learning is what you learned from the experience of actually fighting back, because not most people, most people don't actually manage to fight back. We're all doing our best as journalists. Michael was the scientist, the man in front of all this. What was that like? What happened, and what did you learn from the experience?
Yeah, so this was a 12-year-long court case against individuals with the National Review online and the Competitive Enterprise Institute who had made defamatory allegations of fraud against me. They had compared me to a convicted child molester. It turns out that a Washington, D.C. jury didn't think that that was honest discourse. They didn't think that that was simply expressing opinion. There were actionable claims of misconduct that they were already aware had been refuted because there had been multiple investigations by the National Science Foundation, National Academy of Sciences, and many others. And so when you're a public figure, as I now am, the standard in winning a libel case is quite high. You have to prove actual malice, which means not only that the statements were false, but that they knew they were false or that they showed reckless disregard for the truth. And the jury was convinced that, no, these were not honest opinions. These they were clearly making false allegations, and to add insult to injury, comparing me to a convicted child molester, that was probably the reason that the punitive damages were far larger than the compensatory damages.
$1 versus $1 million.
$1 versus $1 million. To me, there is a larger lesson here, and I learned quite a lot over the course of these 12 years about our legal system. I actually have more faith now in the legal system. When you see a jury deliberate, when you see the body language, you watch how they're reacting to the evidence that's being provided, it gives you some faith in our system, and at a time when there's good reason to be worried about the strength and health of our democracy, I do think that to a large extent our legal system is intact because, at its core, are, you know, the, you know, the decisions of juries who tend to, you know, on the whole, take that, you know, take that, you know, take that job very seriously, and really listen to and weigh the evidence, and you know, it just gave me a lot of reassurance about the, you know, the wisdom that underlies our legal system. And today, when we see that playing out right now with multiple lawsuits involving an ex-president who you know, gave rise to an insurrection, we're all worried about whether or not the system justice will be done. And I have more faith that it will, having gone through the experience myself. I also recognize that justice delayed is justice denied, and justice was delayed in our case. You know, it took 12 years for this to play out because the defendants appealed at every possible stage all the way up to the Supreme Court. And, of course, we see that justice delayed right now is a real threat to these other lawsuits that are playing out that will ultimately determine, you know, the health of our democracy, of our democratic system. I guess a larger lesson to my fellow scientists and to communicators in general is that there are basic protections. You know, it's in science, you know, skepticism is a good thing. There should be healthy give and take. You know, you have the right to challenge scientists, to disagree with them. You have the right to challenge science, to disagree with it in good faith. But when it crosses a line into ideologically motivated, defamatory statements that are not really about, you know, the science and its validity, but are intending to discredit the science and the scientists to further, you know, potential political agenda. When you cross that line, there are still basic protections in our system, and I think our case speaks to that, and I hope that my fellow scientists maybe feel a little bit more room, those who are afraid to speak out, to speak truth to power, to participate in the larger discourse, maybe are a little more willing to do that now, understanding that there are basic protections that are out there to protect them.
So it's one thing to win a legal case, and I think we might talk a little bit later about, you know, how often something is going to rise to the point where it's suitable for a legal case. But obviously it's another thing to convince the public and to convince everyday people of the truth about certain scientific subjects. And that's what I want to actually get to next with you, Kathleen. I often talk about this sort of surprising number of similarities between journalists and scientists. You know, both journalists and scientists are very committed to hewing to the truth. They both want multiple lines of evidence before they publish. They're both measured by what they publish. They're both very competitive professions where, you know, a scientist doesn't want to get scooped and a journalist doesn't want to get scooped. But unfortunately, one of the newer, I think, similarities between science and journalism is that the same kinds of political attacks that have been foisted upon scientists for some time now in this area are also coming down on journalists. Kathleen, I think it was William O. Douglas, one of the Supreme Court justices, who talked about the marketplace of ideas, the argument for freedom of speech in the First Amendment, that, you know, you got to let her rip and have some faith that in the marketplace of ideas, when push comes to shove, truth will win. I have to say, I'm not so sure as I used to be, maybe before iPhones were invented, that truth will win in a natural, fair fight. And I wonder what you would say about what's going on with the politicization against journalism and against sort of this kind of speech?
Well, first, there's a move that is more common now in the past to discredit the person in order to discredit the argument. And so that was the move that was made against Mike, discredit the person on grounds that had nothing to do with the science in order to discredit the science. But one of the things that one can say about the court in which the hearing is held is that it has rules of argument and evidence. It has very carefully rules codified across time about who gets to make what kind of a claim based on what kind of argument and evidence is being offered. That system protected Mike. That system protected the country as more than 60 cases were adjudicated, asking the question, was the election in 2020 rigged? And if we have the available evidence in order to make the arguments, and we are also able to make the case that we know how we know that the evidence is legitimate, we are still able, I think, inside structures that protect that knowledge. The courts do that. Journalism tries to do that. Universities try to do that. And it's a norm of science to do that, that we will come to the knowable as best we can. And people of good faith who still understand the standards of evidence and argument will be more likely, because they understand how we know as well as what we know, to say that we are trustworthy even in the presence of attacks on our personal credibility that are unwarranted.
Well, it's interesting the way you brought academia in, because, of course, I didn't mention that, but academia is finding itself under attack in much the same way that we're seeing for science and journalism these days, and I think it's no surprise. But Kathleen, just to take it a little bit further, you know, there are, and this came up in the last panel, I think, there are a growing number of people on the political right and the people who don't want to talk about climate change who are recognizing the value of seeming like they are journalists, of seeming like they are a journalistic outlet. It's getting a little bit hard to tell who one should trust, even in the seemingly, you know, the seeming sphere of journalism. Do you have faith that actually truth will out?
I don't like to use the word truth, because as a philosophy minor and an undergraduate, I'm more comfortable outside the metaphysical domain. But that the best available that is knowable from the sources that are trustworthy, I think, can win out. And one test of that is, if you scan the QR code, you'll find misconceptions and conspiracy theories about climate that our undergraduate and graduate students looked at this semester, and we asked them to go to sources about those misconceptions and conspiracy theories that a conservative audience or a skeptical audience would be more likely to trust. And for each of these, they were able to find those kinds of sources. And the important Pew Charitable Trust data about areas and agencies that are still trusted suggests, first, contrary to popular understanding, NIH and CDC still enjoy a very high level of trust, although declining somewhat across time. Science still has a high level of trust, even though declining somewhat across time. The trend down on science, by the way, is paralleled by the trend in most other institutions, and science compared to those institutions is still highly trusted. And in the climate area, NASA and NOAA are still highly trusted. So can you find places to lodge a claim in the presence of misinformation, which the public overwhelmingly says, I trust the source, the beginning of accepting the evidence? The answer is still yes. And do those sources, when you turn to them, give you an explanatory framework that explains how we know what we know, as well as marking out what we don't know with appropriate levels of uncertainty, so that when science changes, as it inevitably will in its understanding of knowledge, that isn't marked as a failure of the competence of science, but rather a science doing its job to update knowledge. And so what the work that students have done, and scan the QR codes, you can find those misconceptions and the conspiracy theories, is that, yes, we still have reliable sources to which we as a culture still turn, even in the face of a highly polarized environment, not to find truth, but to find the best available that's knowable by our best people using the best tested methods and regularly updated across time.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And just as a comment for me, when it comes to conveying that trusted information from those expert sources, sometimes it's directly to the public, sometimes it's via journalism, and it has, I think, been brought up a couple of times today already. It's great to remember that local journalism remains, according to Pew Research Center and others, the most trusted journalism. For all of you out in the audience here who are local journalists, bravo. I mean, you are the people who your communities look to and trust for this kind of information. And sometimes I actually think that scientists, I know this from my experience at Sideline, where we're putting scientists and journalists together and giving scientists an opportunity to talk to a journalist. And sometimes they'll say, well, you know, if it's a New York Times or a Wall Street Journal, I'd love to talk to them. But if it's for, you know, the Times-Picayune or something smaller than that, you know, I don't know if it's worth my time. Actually, it's more worth your time than ever, because that's an audience of people who actually could be swayed by what you're about to tell them, as opposed to the audience for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, who already know, I think, how they feel about these things. But let's segue into a little bit more about technique here. Michael, I'm wondering, you know, What are the tricks you try to use when you are talking to journalists, when you are talking to the public?
Now, wait a minute. Tricks? Mike is using tricks? tell me more about those tricks.
You stole my thunder there, Kathleen. But go on.
Well, you know, one thing I was going to just start with as a prompt. We've all heard as journalists forever, oh, the deficit model sucks. You know, you can't just fill an empty space with facts. That doesn't work. There's all these other things you have to take into account. One thing personally that has bugged me about that whole line of talking is that maybe the deficit model isn't enough. Maybe you can't just use facts. But you do have to present the facts,
right?
So what do you do when you're trying to make the facts work?
Yeah, in science, it's what we call necessary or in proving a mathematical proposition, necessary but not sufficient, right?
Right.
So it's a necessary part of it. I actually was part of a Science Online discussion about this with Dan Kahan and several other experts some years ago. And Dan was, of course, articulating his views of the deficit model, information deficit model. And I pointed out that the problem isn't so much a deficit of information, it's a surplus of misinformation. And that's an important distinction that is far more relevant today than it was 10 years ago when we were having that conversation. And so what we have seen, and Kathleen spoke to this, you know, back in the day when Daniel P. Moynihan said, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions but not your own facts, we lived in a world where that was basically true. When I was growing up, there were three television networks. When Walter Cronkite concluded his newscast, and that's the way it was on today's date, we all accepted those facts. We all accepted that that's the way it was. We could agree to disagree about the implications of those facts. And now we've evolved into a situation where people do, feel entitled to their own facts. It's not coincidental. It benefits those bad actors that we've been talking about, the dissolution of our public discourse, division, deflection, all of the fraught aspects of our public discourse today plays into the agenda of powerful interests who don't want an informed electorate and don't want to see successful democratic governance win out. So that's the world we live in today. It's an Orwellian world where those bad actors recognize that, for example, if they could hijack the term fake news early on, then they would in fact immunize themselves against the actual fake news that they are weaponizing to further their agenda. Mm-hmm. That's the world we live in today. Like Kathleen, I am sort of an optimist here. I like to think that in the end, facts, and we won't call it truth because that's a controversial term here today, facts and logic and good faith still play a role. It's not enough. We have to take advantage of all of these, we won't call them tricks, tools that we have to reach people. As you say, you don't just speak to the big national outlets, although AP is sort of interesting because they're a national outlet, but they reach a very diverse group of news outlets out there. But recognizing that it is important to get our message out at every sort of level of the information ecosystem, and that, of course, pertains today to social media. Most young folks today get their information from social media. So if you're a scientist or a communicator, especially one of a certain age, and you just feel like social media isn't for you, you're not comfortable, that's okay. We have to be comfort in the sort of in the information space that we occupy. But recognize that if you're not on social media and you're not getting your message out on social media, you're reaching an increasingly critical audience. It is, in fact, young voters who will determine later this year whether or not we do continue this this democratic experiment, or we go in a darker road. It's so important for us to make sure that young folks are informed, and to do that, we have to participate in sort of every avenue that we have to get information out. We have to think outside of the box. We have to be willing to leave our comfort zone a little bit. and engage in social media and all of these other tools that we have to reach. It's not like it was back in the 1970s when there were three television news networks and everybody got their information from those common sources. It's such a fractured media environment right now that it really behooves us to occupy as much of that environment as we can.
Kathleen, I also want to ask you for sort of your advice to the reporters in this room about how they should go about this job, but I also want to let people know that we'll take questions from the audience soon, so think about questions that you might have for our panelists here. Kathleen, I'm also thinking about the debate, and some of this went on this morning, over sort of focusing on gloom and doom and the worry that that's going to just turn people off, although I was introduced to some data this morning I was unaware of, that the Penn State study that seems to show that maybe that actually motivates people. I'm interested in that. But other people say solutions journalism is the way to go, while people complain as well that, oh, solutions journalism just puts a happy face on things. I have to say, just as a quick example, I saw the big Sunday story. I don't know if there's anyone here from the Times today, but I thought that the big Sunday story on sort of carbon capture technology, which was pretty interesting and solutions-oriented, and yet I had to read something like 1,500 words before I found out that the hundreds of carbon capture machines that are being built out there right now wouldn't even touch 1% of the annual output of, CO2 in this country. I'm not sure I love the structure of that. But, Kathleen, what are you seeing out there, and advice-wise for reporters as they think about how to go about this?
Well, first, Mike is talking in terms of the traditional journalism of the past in relationship to social media. There's an entire category of excellent climate knowledge transmission and communication that is coming from sectors that you wouldn't call traditional news. And those are sources now, because of the digital capacities, that are able to reach large numbers of people who care about getting explanatory frameworks about the very fraught situation in which we were in, that are not disempowering but potentially also increase agency. Mike stresses agency and urgency as he talks about just about everything. And it comes through the quotes that he offers when he talks to you as individuals. But I just want to give a shout-out to all of you, those of you who are the science writers and communicators of the world, who take very complex science and try to find ways to make it accountable in the moment, because some of these solutions don't work as well as they ought to. We want them to work better. We want to hold the people who are putting them forward accountable for making them better, because we need those solutions now. We also need an understanding of the complexities of some of these issues, so that when controversial positions have to be taken that are costly, we have some grounding to understand the benefits and the risks, because everything is going to be a trade-off in benefits versus risks when you're dealing with trying to set priorities. And the collective community that is the climate communicating community, including all the fine climate journalists, is, I think, doing a remarkable job trying to make sure that not only hold those individuals who are driving towards solutions accountable, but they find ways to empower us as individuals to act too. The doomism is in part driven by the idea that as an individual, I'm too small to make a difference. I'm not too small to make a difference. The question is, can I aggregate me collectively up to a large enough numbers to make a difference? And can I activate the networks and structures within I work, with which we collectively work, but I am a part, to ensure that they are going to make a difference? And can I increase the likelihood that we get climate issue voting, so that we get put in place people who will act on a climate agenda that is responsible and makes good use of the available priorities and tax resources? So, to the extent that we have a clear understanding of what those trade-offs are, what the risks and benefits are, and this community is helping inform that, I am actually optimistic that in this fraught circumstance, we will at least do all that we can. For doomism, individuals can matter, but it's going to be in collectivities. It's too late. The science tells us it's not too late, and Mike can tell you why.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks very much for that segue. I agree with everything that Kathleen just said here, and it is something that I'm pretty passionate about, doomism as a potential lead, a path towards disengagement. And I think there is actually a pretty healthy body of social science research that suggests that doomism can lead to disengagement. And it's not coincidental that we do see some bad actors, particularly in those social media spaces, who have weaponized, using bot armies and trolls, have weaponized doomism, because they want to take people who would most likely be on the front lines, environmental advocates and activists, they want them on the sidelines. And convincing them it's too late to do anything about the problem is one way to get there. Now, there is an interesting conversation about sort of concern, raising alarm and concern. That's the urgency. And we do have to convey urgency. But as Kathleen said, I always like to pair that with the fact that we have agency, that it is not too late. And the science has something to say about that. A lot of the doomism that we see is actually premised on some false scientific narratives. For example, we've all heard about the claim that there is runaway warming from methane that's being released from the Arctic and it's unstoppable. There is no science to support that. That's not what's happening. But there are a lot of young folks in particular who have heard that. They believe it. And it does lead to despair and doom and disengagement. Now, what I also want to talk – in the new climate war, I talk about all the obstacles that we face today with denial sort of on the wane because we can all see it's happening. It's very difficult to deny it's happening. So there are all these other tactics that bad actors have used to try to prevent climate action. And doomism is certainly one of them, division, deflection, and, false solutions as well. A delay, delaying action by saying, oh, look, you know, we'll be able to solve this problem 10 years from now by deploying massive networks of carbon absorbing infrastructure that we will sequester. The geoengineering conversation that we're having within which this discussion of carbon capture and sequestration is embedded is a very fraught conversation because on the one hand, scientists feel it's important to talk about, it's important to study because we do have to understand the potential implications. And we might need to deploy something like this down the road, but we do see it being hijacked by polluters and bad actors today as this idea that, look, we will be able to solve this problem cheaply by deploying this technology. Mm-hmm. So we can continue to burn carbon now. We will suck it all back out of the atmosphere. Trust us. do we really want to trust them with the one planet we know of in the universe at this point that supports life? I think not. And so we have to I do think journalists in general, environmental journalists, have done a really good job in covering the nuances of this, the fraught nature of these discussions. But it is really important to recognize that there are some bad actors who are looking to game some of these conversations to their advantage. And we have to be thinking about that in the way we frame and discuss it.
Love that.
There's also a soundbite of Mike's that I'd like him to reproduce for you. So my pass-off capacity is increased by teaching this class with him. When people say it's too late, they've got the wrong horizon in place from a scientific standpoint. So give us one clear statement that everybody could remember that explains why it's not too late.
Yeah. Every bit of carbon that we don't burn makes us better off.
Thank you.
Wow. All right. Nice. Love that. Love the urgency and agency. We probably only have time for a question or two. I'm sorry, but
we have a little more time.
Okay, we've got one person right here, and I want to also encourage, let's get at least one local reporter up to the mic.
I'm a local editor.
Yay.
I'm Christy George. I work for KUOW Radio in Seattle, remotely from Portland. This is a big question, but do you think it's possible that the attacks on racial diversity and democracy in general are being driven by people who have a stake in not dealing with climate change?
I'm happy to – yes. I've talked a fair amount about this as well. There are certain petrostates, Saudi Arabia and Russia, that have an interest in not seeing global climate action and have done everything they can to scuttle any agreements, for example, at the various conferences of the parties. And we have seen them increasingly meddle in foreign elections, often using social media where they can be anonymous and they can use bot armies to try to create these fraught conversations to divide climate advocates, get them debating with each other, get them to repeat the misinformation and the disinformation. They don't want to see climate action. part of what, just a brief aside here, sorry, there was a $500 million oil deal between ExxonMobil and Rosneft, the Russian state oil company, that would have gone forward, that could have gone forward under Donald Trump and would not have gone forward under a President Hillary Clinton. A very compelling argument has been made that that is precisely why Russia interfered in the 2016 election in the way that they did. And they're doing that today. They don't want to see climate action. There are other petrostates that don't want to see climate action. And any distraction they can create right now, any division that they can create right now, helps them. Chaos works to their advantage. Division works to their advantage. And we have to be understanding that any time we see some new global, crisis, it may well be that there are bad actors out there who are fanning the flames of that crisis.
And trying to influence the science and how the science is communicated. And if Mike would just take one more moment, did any of these interests ever have an effect on an IPCC report's most famous statement?
Thank you. It's almost like we might have discussed this in our class. There's a reason that in December 1995, when I was finishing my PhD, the IPCC scientists in the final plenary of the second assessment report spent 3 days debating one word in the summary for policymakers. All of the delegates of the various countries can veto wording in the summary for policymakers. And so there were 3 days spent because certain countries didn't like the statement that there was now a significant human influence on the climate. Those countries, Saudi Arabia, chief among them, objected. It took 3 days to finally find a word that the delegates, the standouts among the delegates and the scientists could agree upon. And this is now a very famous phrase from 1995 IPCC report, Summary for Policymakers. There is now a discernible human influence on the climate. Now think about the difference between significant and discernible. If I squint, I can see it. Saudi Arabia won because that was the language. That was the meek language that came out of the second assessment report in 1995. If we had acted in a concerted manner back then, it would be much easier for us to avert a catastrophic 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. Now we have to bring carbon emissions down by 50% by the end of this decade if we are to do that. We can thank that opportunity cost of decades of action to the actions of bad actors like Saudi Arabia and the fossil fuel interests that were working closely with them.
There's your yes. Do we have time for one more question?
Hi, I'm a local reporter from Southern California. I have a quick and probably naive question for Dr. Mann. We know that carbon dioxide mixes very well with the atmosphere so that local emissions don't have a local warming effect. Is that also true with other, like methane?
Yeah, in terms of the warming impact of the various greenhouse gases, the effect happens at the global scale. They are well mixed on the timescales of relevance. But some of these pollutants obviously have health impacts as well. Ozone, ground-level ozone, nitrous oxide. So there are certain greenhouse gases that have both an immediate and local impact on health quality, and this is a climate justice problem because who's exposed to all of those toxic gases? It's in general frontline communities, people who live in low-income areas. But in terms of climate change, the relevance is at the global scale.
One last quick question.
For Kathleen.
For Kathleen.
Which I will pass to Mike.
Hi, I'm Sarah Volpenhein. I'm with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. One of the arguments that I hear a lot from skeptics, whether of, the outcome of the 2020 election or of climate change or what have you, is that, interests for example, in what you were just talking about in 1995, whether they be political or the funders of scientists are perhaps swaying or influencing the outcomes of their research. And I wonder what you have found is like a good way to respond to those kinds of criticisms of skeptics.
Could you maybe rephrase it very quick, like very simply, the question?
That yeah. Scientists are being influenced, that their science and their results are being influenced
science
by funders.
Science are being bought.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, it's very bad, actually. Some scientists are bought. And there are great organizations. A friend of mine who's standing in the room has done amazing work at Greenpeace, for example, exposing the fossil fuel industry funding of various scientists who ironically take contrarian positions about climate change. It's amazing. And they get enough you give them enough fossil fuel money and they're willing to sort of provide a fossil fuel friendly narrative. And so there's no question that there are some scientists who have sold their scientific soul to industry. But if anything, the point I would make is that scientists tend to be very cautious. And I think we have the opposite problem when you get consensus reports, like the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They're sort of a scientific lowest common denominator. It's the thing that thousands of pretty conservative scientists can all agree upon. So you always come up with a conservative sort of take on the science, in my view. If anything, what we've seen is that many of the impacts that we're seeing, the melting of ice sheets and sea level rise, extreme weather events that we're now suffering through, many of these impacts are proceeding faster than we predicted just decades ago with the models. And so uncertainty isn't our friend. If anything, uncertainty has broken against us. It's a reason for even more concerted action. And I think that it's important to convey that if anything, the problem is just the opposite. The scientific community has probably been overly conservative, you could argue, maybe somewhat with the science, but really with the messaging, with the way they've communicated the science to the public, and understandably because they're afraid that they're going to be singled out and called frauds and compared to child molesters, and there is a reason that those sorts of tactics have been deployed against scientists like myself, is to send a message to all the other scientists that this is what will happen to you. And it's, you know, what Naomi Oreskes, my good friend Naomi Oreskes, has written about this. So scientists in their messaging tend to pursue a path of least drama because of the worry that they'll be attacked for being too bold and strident.
And let me add, from the perspective of science as an enterprise, their funders obviously influence you, period. I mean, human nature is such that you're influenced by people you're beholden to. Science sets up structures to minimize the likelihood that that influence is going to affect your findings, increases the likelihood that if it's there, it's disclosed, and as a result, you can scrutinize the findings differently because you know funders. That's why the best of the journals require self-disclosure of all funders, and not doing so will be an automatic basis for retraction. Science also, through the peer review process, when it works, has individuals who have a competitive advantage in discrediting your science because they're knowledgeable in the area. The culture of critique of science is what gives you self-correction in science. My self-interest is advanced. If I can find a flaw in somebody else's science, that benefits science because now we found the flaw. Now somebody else will find the flaw in my science. That's how we iterate. If the retraction process works, when a flaw is pointed out, the journals retract promptly because universities have done appropriate investigations, do it promptly, and as a result, the literature is corrected. So we have scientific processes set up to minimize the natural influence of funding structures on our science and also the natural human biases effect on our findings. We're all disposed to confirmation bias, hence not to see the parts of the results we don't like. But science is set up structurally to try to minimize the effect, and that's part of the reason science is a reliable way of knowing compared to most other ways, more reliable than most other ways.
That's a great reminder. And one last point I'll make that I actually heard from you before, Kathleen, but I think it's really important maybe to close with here, is that remember, it's not about any individual scientific finding. What's beautiful about the way that science works and the way science is closing in on what's really happening with climate change is the multiple lines of evidence that are all coming together from different directions and saying the same thing. That's when you can really start believing that we're onto something, and I think that's where we're at today.
As a result, we shouldn't talk about consensus. We should talk about convergent evidence.
Great, great point. Thank you. Thanks to Michael. Thanks to Kathleen for a super interesting conversation.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you all for what you're doing.
Thanks, everyone.
Just 5 or 10 minutes to talk about this evening?
Yeah, sure. My confidence in the press's ability.
That was great, Michael. You're perfect.
Kathleen here is like, she's the everything.
Delivered
wisdom from the highest source here.
You guys have a great.
I felt like we complimented each other.
It's not true. If you look throughout the pandemic, those people who are following mainstream news and traditions are much larger in numbers. When you look at what their news feeds have in social media, a lot of social media that we get is actually mainstream news. Those who get most of their information are the most likely to have the science-consistent answers on anything we ask. So if you pick an area into the health domain, and we've asked across more than COVID, what you're going to find is there is still a massive influence, because
we can find you some experts. Michael can tell you what the science is. But the science tells you that he should be responsible to you.
But putting in place the reliable knowledge that reduces susceptibility is actually the most important thing that mold does.
So comfortable here.
Thank you so much. Nice to meet you in person.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to your student.
Oh, right.
Yes. Awesome. I just had a mystery. I'm so glad you guys
said that.
Wait a minute. Is this right? Yes.
Thank you. And I have a couple of questions.
Sure. I mean, I'm going to be like around in reception. I'm here through the end of the thing.
Hi. Diane is so wonderful to meet in person. Yes.
Oh, thanks for all you.
A while ago, but not recently. I
do not believe that the big outlets are important.
Sorry.
USA Today reaches a very broad and influential audience.
We do. It's amazing to me sometimes how many subscribers. But I came from Berkeley, so I do believe
that
you focus on
the
past.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, definitely. Well, you do have to do some sort of triage, and usually. But
guys, we gotta get Mike out of here, so we can catch up with him.
Reed's missing.
Yeah, Reed's missing.
Anyone want to come and talk and stuff? Anyone? Who's covered this for you?
He got nervous.
Lee's like, I don't know what he looks like. Oh, man. Hey, Terry.
Oh, no, I'm fine. We're usually like looking for one of the
Well, one of our people's missing. Do you want to come on the panel instead? You want to hop on up here? Wait, who was the person?
His name is Isha.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, that's cute. That's really cute. We're like a duo. Chef Ron Shell. Yeah, I was there at the beginning. She was started it really good, really strong, yeah. There's another guy up there, yeah, that's like I think he's a professor or something like that, yeah. They're just talking about how utilities work and, like, why we're seeing raise, at least when I was leaving, like, why prices were rising, what were the factors.
It's January in New Orleans.
That's what she kind of did last year, and honestly, people found it really helpful because it's such a hard topic to understand. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, wait, what? What does that line actually mean? Yeah, and like, obviously, the consumer benefits aren't happening.
No, you're not.
Well, I'm the moderator, so I have to, like, ask them questions, then I get to turn my brain off as they answer. Oh, did you? You did decide to pull a Mario and spitball it? He spitballed his acceptance speech for the...
You have points, though.
He was good. He started with like a crowd, like, raise your hand if, you know, so we got the crowd interested, and then I was very much like...
We got nervous. Oh, good. Okay, yeah.
When you do speak into the mic, though, you have to do it kind of close, so just pull it close.
Paging Reed Frazier. Reed Frazier to the principal's office, please.
Frazier. Frazier.
Do you see him? Yes. Oh, good. Okay.
Is he just too busy schmoozing?
Hi. Oh, hello. How's it going?
All right, everyone, we're going to start soon.
Not really. Small.
Yeah. All right, if everyone can take their seats and quiet the chatter, we're going to get started on our next panel. All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Miranda Green. I'm the Director of Investigations at Floodlight. Thanks for coming out today. And welcome to our panel on covering disinformation. We have a strong group of reporters who largely face disinformation in both the topics that they cover and just on the day-to-day reporting. And I want to introduce them now before we get started. So to the left of me, we have Mario Ariza, who is my colleague from Floodlight. He is an investigative reporter based in Miami, and his work currently focuses on how power companies are leveraging dark money. Then we have Reed Frazier. He's an energy reporter with the Allegheny Front, a Pittsburgh-based public media outlet, and is a contributor to NPR's Climate Collaborative of local public radio producers and reporters. He's been covering the fracking industry since 2011 in Pennsylvania and also the coal and petrochemicals industries, so he is probably one of the best people to ask about what's going on in the state that we're currently in. And lastly, we have Amy Westervelt. She's a reporter who's been covering climate for more than 20 years. She launched the Peabody-nominated podcast production company Critical Frequency, which is known for its very popular and one of my favorite climate podcasts, Drilled. All right, so I know that we've already talked a lot about disinformation and what it actually means. So I want to just give a quick refresher. The definition, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, is false information deliberately and often covertly spread, as by the planting of rumors, in order to influence public opinion or obscure the truth. And as climate reporters, we face this frequently. So I want to first start with you, Mario. Give us an instance. Can you describe one experience that you've had in your reporting where you've come across disinformation and reported on it? And tell us why you think the lie or falsehood merited a story on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess because we're talking about climate change, probably the most interesting bit of climate disinformation I've had the chance to write about is this idea that net metering, which is a policy by which you get paid a certain amount of money to put power back into the grid from your solar panels, is bad for minorities, right? It costs people on the socioeconomic spectrum towards the lower end and people of color money. Now, the utilities have put a lot of money and a lot of work towards putting this narrative forward. And it's not exactly, shall we say, the truthiest bit of information, right? Frankly, yeah, there is a point at which if everybody has solar panels on a particular electric grid, there's a cost to the grid. You got to increase the carrying capacity of the grid. You got to make sure it's able to move all those electrons. That's going to cost people money. But those penetration rates are 5 to 7%. And we wrote a story about how a pair of consulting firms who worked for power companies, two of the largest power companies in the United States, Southern Company and NextEra Energy, which is the parent company of Florida Power and Light, had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to basically co-opt civil rights organizations into delivering the message that putting solar panels on your house was going to be bad for you if you were of the particular demographic that the civil rights organization worked for. And in the states where this was operating, like this campaign was operating, that was just a frankly not true, right? These are states that have less than 1% penetration of solar in the market. It's not costing anybody anything at that point. But I had to go 12 rounds with the speaker, with the public information officer at EEI, the Edison Electric Institute, about this in order to pin that fact down, right? So just a piece of misinformation or disinformation, specifically disinformation. But the delivery vehicle here was really, really fascinating and really, really interesting. And it frankly took a seven-month investigation to write about.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to skip over Reed and go to Amy. I wanted to ask you kind of the same question. A lot of the work that you have done has touched on disinformation, and specifically in how the fossil fuel industry produces this through advertising. What has your reporting found as the main driver for this strategy?
I would say that the strategy hasn't changed really since the 70s. It's Jeffrey mentioned his favorite obsession and mine, Herb Schmertz, in the first panel. he was the VP of public affairs for Mobil from like the late 60s to the early 90s. And he used to talk about influencing the influencers, and that is very much still the case. You know, I was leaked a document in maybe 2019 by someone who was working for an ad agency that had been contracted by BP to do some of the work around their most recent, like, we're just an energy company rebrand. And it was clearly the same strategy. You know, they were at that time, this is pre-COVID, so they were very concerned about the youth climate movement and how to, quote unquote, seem authentic, especially to young people, and how like that movement in particular had really eroded their ability to influence. So yeah, they're looking for influence. That's why they spend so much in the content marketing and advertorial realm as well. You know, Jeffrey mentioned that earlier too, but like we're not talking small spends here. You know, like, the New York Times alone, it was $20 million over 3 years just from oil companies in advertorial, and that is a conservative number. It does not include all the creative fees. So that's the kind of money that they're spending to wrap themselves in the credibility of a respected media outlet. And they do it because they know who reads the New York Times, and they're trying to reach very specific audiences of people.
Yeah, I want to dig into that a little bit more because obviously the disinformation angle is one thing. It's the desire to inform in a way that's not truthful. But then also there's the impact, right? How successful are they in this disinformation campaign? So, you know, what would you say is the success rate for some of these advertising campaigns you've seen? I mean, including are people duped by what they're reading in these ads?
It's hard to measure the impact of any one ad. You know, PR, there's lots of like internal PR firm reports where they're like, this ad was so successful, but like, of course they're going to say that and they're going to tell their clients that, right? However, we do know from peer-reviewed research that, you know, at most 1 in 3 people can tell the difference between advertorial and editorial. A lot of studies have found it to be much worse, like more 1 in 10 realm, you know? So people are, and especially when a lot of this stuff is not, like, they're not taking out climate denial ads anymore. They're taking out ads that are like, carbon capture is going to capture, has the potential to capture 90% of emissions. the potential is doing a lot of work in that sentence. They're not technically lying. Even if one of these outlets fact-checked that, like, it might pass muster in that sense, you know, but it totally contradicts what the reporting is saying, and it you know, it introduces doubt in areas where there really shouldn't be, and that's also the point. So, you know, we can't do, like, a one-to-one map of, like, this ad ran and then everybody voted for this policy, but they don't spend this kind of money if it doesn't work, and they've been doing it for decades, you know? So yeah.
Great. So in our line of work, we often see disinformation, as I said before, in two ways. We both cover it, and then we also experience it, and we kind of have to figure out a way to get through it and get past it to get to the story that we're covering. I want to talk about the second kind. For example, I personally covered a story about solar farms across the United States, and one conspiracy theory that I heard over and over again from farmers is that solar panels leach chemicals into the ground, which then causes cancer. This is not factual. This is not based in science, but it is something that everyday people I talk to who were concerned about putting solar on their own farms or concerned about their neighbors putting solar on their farms brought up. And it's hard to know how to address that with sources sometimes in real time, or how to bring it up in the piece later without feeling like you're doing a disservice to the people that you talk to that are real human beings. So, Reed, I wanted to ask you, you cover local news in an area where there's a strong fossil fuel influence. How do you maintain your relationship with the industry and your coverage of it, especially in instances where you feel like the company's representatives might not be telling you the whole truth or might be giving you data that you feel is a little funky?
Thank you. How do I maintain my relationship? It's probably not, you know, we're probably, you know, not the best relations, but I'm fair as far as I can tell with everyone I deal with, even if I don't really think they're telling the truth all the time. I think, you know, when I first started covering this industry, I had come directly from the science writing world where you kind of write about cool stuff doctors and, you know, scientists are learning about the human body or the universe or whatever, dinosaurs. That was cool. And my friend, we're sort of acquaintances, but now she's my boss, recruited me to this job. And I was like, yeah, that's interesting. Like, fracking was sort of new in Pennsylvania. And I thought it would be a very a chance to, like, exercise the things I'd learned science writing, learn about geology, learn about engineering and all these things. And I did learn about these things. That's totally still was the case. But I did not comprehend that most of my job would be covering sort of politics and some policy, but mostly kind of wading through rhetoric, essentially, pointed statements that sort of were well-crafted to leave you to leave the newcomer confused as to how accurate they were. And I got to say, I think it really works. As Amy said, they wouldn't do it if it doesn't work. So I think one way I sort of, I mean, this is like a really small thing, and I was trying to think of, like, what are some pointers I can give to people who maybe are just starting out in this field, or, you know, maybe fracking's coming to your area or whatever. It doesn't really matter what industry it is. But I really look closely, like 99% of the time when I'm doing a story about a natural gas company, they're not going to agree to an interview to be taped. They're going to send, you know, a pre-vetted statement through their, I'm sure it's been looked at by their lawyers and their PR team. But I tend to just really avoid things that are patently, like, unverifiable, like, what's some of the language they always send? All right, clean,
yeah, please
affordable.
Give us some examples.
Yeah, like, clean, affordable natural gas is something they're always going to slip in their press statements. And, I mean, it's smart because it's going to get through. Like, there's local reporters that are on deadline and are just going to copy and paste that paragraph into their story for the next day. But I just don't, you know, unless it's like something I can verify, something I know, I don't put that, sometimes I just paraphrase and say, you know, they didn't think they did anything wrong. They said they followed all the rules or something like that. But I do not put stuff like that in the copy of the story. I mean, that's a small thing. Obviously, you should do that, but kind of needs to be said sometimes. So there's other things, but I'll stop there.
Well, as a follow-up to that, what about when it's not the fossil fuel industry that's kind of using these talking points, but it's the people that you're covering themselves? How have you worked around that?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so the solar panel thing is an interesting thing that you brought up, because I encountered the same exact theory, Facebook story, when I was covering solar kind of for the first time up in Mercer County in northwestern Pennsylvania. There's a lot of interest from solar developers up there for various reasons. And, you know, so I'm talking to the neighbors and trying to figure out why they're against. There was a lot of opposition to these solar farms for various reasons. But, I mean, the main reason was they didn't want to look at a solar farm, and they were probably a little bit culturally, like, not trusting of the solar industry, which is, you know, it's just a fact. But that theory, there's chemicals in the solar panel that's going to drain our groundwater. And you know when, like, somebody tells you something that so, like, catches you off guard, you, like, don't know what to say? Has that ever happened to anybody here? Mm-hmm. I'll bet you it has. I didn't know what to say. I was like, oh. It was one of those, like, So it was just, like, a learning experience for me to, like, the point is, arm yourself with the facts. Like, next time when I do this story, I will know whether or not that theory is true. And it's something I do stop people now, maybe not in the beginning, about climate change, who are, you know, saying something like, well, we don't know what's causing all this climate change. And I do stop them, and I say, we do. Like, scientists say we do. So having said that, like, we're not going to do that anymore. So these are things that you pick up over time, and, like, you do the best you can. So I don't know.
Great. Amy, on one season of your podcast, you focused on California fishermen who sued a fossil fuel giant, but who still personally struggled with accepting the reality of climate change. How did you navigate that in the course of your reporting?
Yeah, this is the story I always think of as the reason that primary documents are so important, because I was kind of surprised that half of the people I was talking to who are named plaintiffs in this case were like, ice ages, sunspots, volcanoes, you know, like, it could be natural, we don't know. And I was like, huh, well, have you seen this in that document? And they hadn't, and I showed it to them. And then I also asked them why they had joined the case, if they felt this way, because I was like, but you're in a climate case. and they said, well, we were shown patents that the oil companies had applied for in the 80s mostly, and it was for things like a tanker that could navigate a melting Arctic, or an offshore oil platform that could, you know, was re-engineered for sea level rise. So it was these very clear examples of the industry preparing itself for climate impacts. And they were like, that just didn't seem fair to us, that you know, they prepared themselves for this, but they told us not to worry about it, so we didn't have the same amount of time to prepare. So for them, I don't know, in this weird, and in that moment I was like, okay, I don't actually need to convince you that climate science is real. Like, maybe it's too high of a bar for, like, you know, we're not a particularly scientifically literate populace. Like, let's just put that out there too. Yeah. Maybe it's enough for people to have this understanding of, I wasn't given the same amount of information, And that information enabled a company to make decisions that has protected that company. And I didn't get the same opportunity, and that's just not fair. So actually, like, that one story really shifted my thinking on this stuff in general. And also, I kind of, like, just carry a few, like, clutch documents on my phone.
you whip them out.
I do, and I have the Google patent search, like, in as one of my, you know, windows. Because that's a good one, because they can't accuse you of Photoshopping it.
Interesting.
If you do the search, like, live in front of them, they're like, huh, you know.
It's not a video. All right, so sometimes journalists are criticized for kind of crying wolf when we use the word disinformation, too many things, maybe we're labeling that. And this maybe is a fair criticism. We're known for being a bit dramatic in our professions, but in the good kind of way, I think. But as you three cover your stories, how do you gauge what is worth covering critically? You know, where do you draw that fine line between positive advertisements and kind of the typical positive spin that you see and blatant disinformation and false claims? Or is it really not that easy to decipher? Mara, you don't want to start?
Yeah, sure, I'll start. So who here has heard the term corporate influence campaign? All right, like a couple people, right? It's an industry, right? And it's an industry that I think journalists should be really well aware of. It's how corporations often seek to shape public opinion about their products. And there's a whole industry called the product defense industry, which specializes in corporate influence campaigns. This is, of course, the tobacco lobby, their playbook. But, you know, the alcohol industry has got one. You know, the pork industry has one, right? This is a factor of American life. And it goes back to that question that the very kind Bloomberg reporter asked earlier today. Like, well, what's the difference between this kind of, you know, disinformation and what you see every day that a corporation's doing or you know, legitimate political discourse? To be clear, a disinformation campaign under the current rubric of our free and open society is legitimate political discourse. It's just also my job to like the truth and to tell the truth. And if you're not telling the truth, well, I'm going to call it out, right? And so where do you draw the line on why to cover something? Well, if you can follow the money back to the corporation doing the corporate influence campaign and it's harming the climate and you're an environmental reporter, convince your editor, right? That's where I draw it.
Do either of you guys want to weigh in on that?
Sorry, I also look and see how much research they've done that contradicts what they're saying, which is often a lot. It's not, it's like not as rare as one might think that they, yeah. And also look at like what they're saying in their shareholder and analyst calls versus mm-hmm. like what they're telling, you know, a paper, because they're a lot more, I don't know, free and easy in those conferences too, like conference speeches, transcripts of conference things. They post a lot of videos from their conferences online too. There's all these like places that you can look for like where they've talked about this amongst themselves. And if that contradicts what they're telling the public, then I feel like it's a very clear-cut case.
Yeah.
And again, it like gives you that primary source to be like,
no, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the 10-Ks of a lot of the gas companies in the South, right? They often have a disclaimer. Like, hey, look, the climate's warming. That may impact people's use of natural gas to heat their homes. So invest accordingly. And you're like, wait, are you warning your investors that climate change is going to erode your profits?
They just did this. They just actually, like, a bunch of them just reduced their production volumes because it was an unseasonably warm winter. And they're trying to, like, get prices back up. So they're, you know.
I didn't actually have any thoughts.
No thoughts. Okay. The last question I want to ask before I open it up to questions is, this one's a little bit of left field, but we talked about this before, which is, you know, one of the ways to fight disinformation is to get more information. And as reporters, our job is to talk to a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle, or in this case, about climate and those who are defending the things that are causing climate, right? I have heard criticism in conversations I've had with professors and editors that journalists these days are not going to real people and asking them for comment. They're not calling people on the phone as much as they used to, and they're just kind of sending in questions via email. When they don't get responses back, they say no comment, and it makes stories seem very one-sided. I also, on the flip side of that, know that as a reporter, it has become increasingly hard to get industry to respond to any sort of comment. I wrote a story on Chevron that came out last week. We were literally in Chevron's backyard for 4 days. They would not meet with us. On Monday, we called them and said, we're here. And they said, our week has magically gotten really busy. And then the next week, when we asked for follow-up questions, it was magically Sarah week, and they just couldn't take any questions. But then a day before our deadline, all of a sudden we had to wait 3 hours for them to give us written comments back. So I think my question is when we are trying our hardest to be fair, or at least make sure that the reporting we have is accurate, so giving, you know, the fossil fuel industry, utility companies, whoever we're reporting on, the chance to comment and correct, how do you do that if they're refusing to play ball or maybe waiting till the story's out so that they can then tell you afterwards what's wrong and ask for correction?
Yeah. I think I'll start because that's like very common feeling is like you're trying to get comment. You know, it's not going to be like a pleasant conversation or whatever, like a little bit antagonistic. But I think what you did sounds like what you got to do. I mean, that just sounds like what you do in that situation is, what was it? It was about the newspaper in Richmond? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like, why do you guys own a newspaper in Richmond? Like, why don't you cover the refinery and all their pollution or whatever? Whatever your questions were, I'm sure you put them to them, you know, clearly. But that is a tactic that... The not responding really until after the story is over, and then they call you and say, "I'll read." You know, this is all off the record, okay? Like, and it's just like a bunch of talking points to sort of wear you down and make you not want to cover the story the next time. It's like in baseball when they throw 6 inches from your head and knock you in the dirt. It's like so you. You know, you're not as enthusiastic about crowding the plate the next time. So I just feel like, unfortunately, they have a seemingly unlimited budget for these kinds of people. And, you know, we've all heard the statistics about there's more PR. I don't know. Six to one. Thank you, Amy. Appreciate it. Makes me feel great. So, I don't know. I mean, just stand in there, really. That's the only thing you can do. And I don't know. Any other suggestions?
I always give them a very long lead time and like plenty of options, opportunities. I do like to cold call people.
Oh yeah.
Also, I have found there are a number of people who are intimidated to call, like, you know, the head of the think tank who crafted whatever strategy. Right? They don't think they're doing anything wrong. They don't think they have anything to hide from you, for the most part. Industry spokespeople a little bit different. Like, they're very media trained, and they're trying to tell you something. But a lot of times, like, people will just answer your questions. I also, my final, like, attempt is usually, like, hey, I'm just fact-checking this. It's going live in, like, 2 hours. And then they usually, like, will respond. But, yeah, there's, like, only so much you can do. And I don't know. And I do like to make sure that I'm very armed with the facts when I have that conversation, so that when they say, like, this happened with we did a story on Guyana and Exxon a couple years ago, and the Exxon spokesperson, I have a weird relationship with Exxon where they good cop, bad cop me a lot. Like, I'll get the mean guy, and then I'll get Megan, who's like, hey, girl, how was your weekend? You know? Great, Megan. How about yours? So, Megan, was like, I'm, you know, I understand why some of the experts you've spoken to, you know, think this and this and this, but actually, you know, it works this way. And I was like, okay, well, I spoke with someone at the EPA who said that in the U.S., the regulation would be this, and that what you did in Guyana would be illegal in the U.S. What's your response? And she's like, oh, you should really talk to this person that made our floating production vessel about that. And I was like, okay, great. Like, put me in touch. And then, like, that person was on vacation and, you know, whatever else. It just sort of, like, petered out. But, like, because I had kind of done all of the work before I talked to her, you know, I was able to catch old Megan off guard.
You're like, Megan, this is the one question I need from you. Do you have an answer? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would also say, like, don't be afraid to make the messenger the story, especially if you're dealing with a public company or you're dealing with the press office of a governor or something like that. If somebody is engaging in serious disinformation, I mean, I remember in my early days as a reporter during the breakout of the COVID crisis, I think this was Ron DeSantis' second spokesperson. He would just spend his day on Twitter saying lies about the disease, right? And a bunch of the other reporters that I was working with or across Florida would engage with him in these Twitter flame wars. And like, I don't want to do that. Let me just write a story about this guy. So we did. And he got fired 2 months after, right? And then he got replaced by somebody who was arguably, you know, an improvement on the model, shall we say? There are times, especially with a gubernatorial spokesperson or with, you know, the spokesperson for a public company who has a duty to tell his investors the truth and to tell the public the truth, they might be a part of the story, right? And so their obfuscation could itself be part of it.
Yes, totally. Like, my favorite, I always name the PR person, and they will often ask to not be personally named. And I'm like, no. In fact, actually, the COP, so we did a story on COP, COP28 last year, and particularly on like the massive PR effort that led to an oil company president being in charge of a climate summit. Yeah. And the former VP of one of said PR firms, Edelman, was like the intern, was the COP28 spokesperson, right? And he sent us very detailed responses. And then we quoted him in the story. And he sent an email later being like, oh, I didn't mean for you to attribute those to me. And I'm like, tough shit. Like, you know, if you, like, you made your bed, you know, like, you're the person who's doing this job. You're the public official spokesperson. They can ask, but, like, you don't owe it to them to go along with that. And honestly, I feel like sometimes it is embarrassing for them to be quoted enough times saying these things.
Yeah. I will add, too, that this has happened to me so many times now that I have sometimes found the best way to get PR people to quote in a story is finding places where they're talking about themselves to other PR people. So industry podcasts and like industry newsletters are gold mines. Like, they're basically bragging about what they do to other people so that they can do it there. And so you get them in these kind of like caught off guard moments where they're fully named, fully entitled, and it's all for the taking. And that's better than anything you're going to get from them if they agree to an interview. So public sourced interviews are honestly sometimes better than what you're going to get yourself. So I found that.
So, okay. There's industry podcasts where there are oil PR people telling other oil PR people they do.
This was something we found. Actually, my colleague Christy was helping me on this story, and she found this for Alabama Power. Alabama Power is financially tied to two newspapers in Alabama, and they launched Alabama News Center a year after Chevron launched the Richmond Standard. And the guy was giving an interview to it was a comms podcast, communicators, PR professionals podcast, talking about like, oh, what a smart idea that, I can't remember what they called it, but it was like news first websites or like news like, it was kind of this crossbreed between obviously a PR PR website and a newspaper, and they were talking about this grand new idea of how they launch their own newspapers and how it's so much more efficient than pitching to reporters because now they can just put up their own news and write positively about themselves and the communities that they're in, of course. And so he was talking about this, and you know, in the interview, he said, "You know, we look to Chevron and what they're doing is so great in Richmond, and so we decided." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is a dream come true!" You know, quote, 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 quote. So we found that through a Google search. We literally just kept Googling them, and this podcast came up, and we spent 30 minutes listening to it. But yeah, this stuff exists. And I have another reporter I worked with, Taylor Kate Brown, who found a very similar situation for Natural Allies. Natural Allies of the Future is it's a gas for clean energy future. Yes, it's a gas company. It's a gas campaign to make, you know, positive advertisements that gas is green, specifically targeting youth and people of color. And their founder spoke openly at a couple podcasts about who they were specifically targeting, which was great because we had the data from Facebook showing that. But then we had someone telling us, no, this was the plan all along, and so it ended up, you know, making the story that much stronger.
Conference videos too, like a lot of times they'll like post them on YouTube and yeah, I mean
conference videos is what she said in case no one heard.
Yeah, sorry, these mics are.
All right, I want to open up to questions now. I think we have roughly 20 minutes to answer questions. So if anyone has any, Lee's coming on with a microphone over there.
Hi, Whitney Bauck, freelancer. This is kind of just following up on things that you've talked about before, and you were mentioning some sort of government employees and turning the messenger into the story. But if you're dealing with something where you are like really needing an answer from a government agency and they're just ghosting and then doing the thing where like the day after, or maybe the next story that's on a similar thing, like, why didn't you reach out to us? I'm like, well, I emailed you 7 times and called you 15. Like, I don't know what else you want from me. What is the line between trying to maintain the kinds of relationships where you can potentially get information from those people in the future and being like, realistically, you are not trying to work with me. It's not worth me calling you 15 times before the next story?
I would just keep calling them. I mean, I don't. It's like, you know, we all have to arbitrage our time in life. So, you know, I mean, I don't think it's ever a waste of time to reach out to. And also, say you've called them 15 times in your story, like repeated or whatever the adjective is. I mean, just keep calling them like it's... It's not.
Wouldn't it be great if we put the number in there? After 15 attempts for comment.
Yeah.
So-and-so denied.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you're just like, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to say, you know, I've tried many times to reach these people. They did not return, but I don't know.
Can you FOIA their emails? I mean, if you can FOIA their emails and search term, you know, where they're talking about you and where they're talking about how they're not going to talk about you.
Yeah.
Shucks. Yeah.
Yeah.
There may not be a story in there, but all of a sudden they'll start responding.
It's a great tweet.
Yeah.
Question over here.
Hi, Zoya, work for Grist. And I had just begun working for Grist when I noticed that ExxonMobil was putting out all these ads about green algae and how it was going to power the future. And I couldn't figure out, you know, what that really meant or how it would work. And I ended up finally calling the company headquarters, and I asked to speak to the algae department, and she had no idea what I was talking about. And I wrote a story about that, and, you know, I was 23 at the time, so it might have been a function of my age, but I was like, wow, I blew this wide open. This is going to make a real difference. It didn't. Exxon is still investing in algae, allegedly, but, like, also has kind of retired at the same time, but, like, still is flooding Facebook with ads. It's, like, a whole thing. So I guess my question is about impact. Like, how do you measure impact? It's the ultimate like David Goliath story, right? Where like it feels like we're throwing these stones and there's no shift really, apart from these, like, you know, obviously the mega stories about how Exxon knew, you know, decades ago, but I guess I'm wondering, how do you guys in your work measure your impact when it comes to these types of stories?
Well, yeah, it is frustrating because I feel like as soon as you sort of like expose one front group, they just like shut it down and start a new one that's the same thing with a different name. So it's tough. But I don't know. I feel like things actually do need to be repeated over and over and over again. And like, we get kind of hung up on like the one story that is going to hold the people accountable or whatever. And like, I just don't think it actually works that way. I feel like it's like, oh, after 10 years of like 100 people covering this, it's sort of like sunk in. So yeah, I don't know. That's not a very good answer because it's basically like, I hope for the best, Zoya. but that's kind of, yeah, I feel like well, I'm going to keep doing it and like, and hopefully other people will keep doing it and there will be enough of these things that like eventually when people see a name like Partnership to Address Global Emissions, a real front group name, they'll be like, this is probably bullshit.
I would say two things. One, like, you never know what the effect of your reportage is going to be, right? So sometimes I'll put out articles and I'll be like, oh yeah, this one's going to be, you know, and then it's like a puff of wind. But then there are other times you put stuff out and then all of a sudden the CEO of the company you're writing about steps down a couple months afterward and you're like, what? Huh? What was going on there? And I still don't have the answers for that. But I mean, I think a lot about I'm reading or listening to the Final Days, which is the Woodward and Bernstein account of like the end of the Nixon presidency, and like just the amount of heat on that guy for that long, Nixon, psychologically, was not good for him, right? It wasn't, right? It constrained his possibility of action, and it really shifted what he could say, and he totally lost credibility with the American public. And I'd like to think that if there are actors in the Nixonian bend, right, in this particular space, a lot of coverage about what they're doing every single day can't hurt because it gives a lot of people the information necessary to make their decisions about these actors.
Yeah, I just want to jump on that from like a much – that's the dream. The dream is that you got to – you know, well – none of us are reporting to do that. But accountability journalism is that you want to hold things accountable. And so that's the dream, is if you see action from your reporting. But I also think that on a small scale, especially for, you know, daily reporters or local reporters, your impact is that people are reading stories they wouldn't be reading otherwise. You are offering intel. You're offering information that would not be out there if it wasn't for you asking the right questions. And that alone is really impactful because it means that you're educating people. It means that they have more information at their disposal to make decisions about their lives, what kind of stove they want to put into their home, who they want to vote for. And I think that that kind of stuff is, you know, the impact is that making sure that people are aware and they're not being duped. And I think that is kind of ultimately what I measure my success by.
And I'll just chip in here. Like, I have a lot of things to say here, but thank you for doing the algae story. That was great.
Yeah, that was a great story.
It's a great story. And it needs to be told like every day for the rest of our lives. And just in terms of like impact, like, you know, I think in this business, we like fixate on like, you won the big prize that everyone relishes. And, like, that's great. The people who get those prizes, it's awesome. But, you know, as a local reporter, it's very gratifying to have people think. Like, I can't tell you how many times people, like, a lot of my stories, typical story is, like, your well is polluted. The company just up the street denies responsibility. And you feel like you're taking crazy pills. And you're like, what the hell is going on? Just to have somebody come out there with a microphone or a notebook mm-hmm. and just look you in the eye and ask you what's going on, like you're not a crazy person, is like, that is it. You know, like, just, it's so cliche, but like feeling seen, you know, like, you know, I just think people want to not feel like they're going insane, like they're not imagining all this stuff is happening, that there is some like reality to what they are experiencing. And I think to sort of extrapolate to the climate, you know, spectrum, you know, I just feel like people need to know they're not going insane, that this is actually happening. Like, we need to just say this over and over again. Unfortunately, like, one story is not going to do it for a story this big or an issue this big.
So sorry, I have to say one very small thing, very true thing, and that is that sometimes I measure my impact by, like, whether I can give a bad person a bad day. I really do. I'm like, I hope Richard Edelman hates this story. I do. I have that pettiness. That pettiness keeps me going.
Hi. Thank you so much. My question is around how do you navigate, on the one side, you've got a company and they're just bombarding you with so much really...
Oh, I'm sorry,
really...
can you say your name and where you're from?
Oh, hi, sorry. I'm Nimra and I'm from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And my question is around dealing with... Say you've got a company and they're just bombarding you with so much really, really complicated language that's just convoluting your reporting so much, and you don't want to get sued, but you also need an average Joe to be able to read your reporting and understand, you know, what you're trying to tell them and who you're trying to hold to account. How do you kind of deal with that?
Reed, it sounds like that's something you've had to deal
like
with.
Sounds like a Reed thing. yeah. I mean, you can always ask them what they're talking about. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, these companies are going to try to invent whole new ways of speaking about an issue instead of using plain language. It's just a technique for obfuscation. I mean, you could... You know, you can ask for clarification and say, if they wouldn't clarify really what they're talking about, just say that. They wouldn't clarify. I don't know. Sometimes I just leave that stuff out. Like a good example, it's not exactly what you're talking about, but actually Susan Phillips and I, we talk about this a lot. Susan's a great reporter here in Philly for public radio station WHYY, and she covers the environment, natural gas, climate. We often cover public health studies related to fracking. Mm. And when I first started covering it, you know, I'd send the study to the gas industry or the company or whatever, Range Resources or whoever it is, and they would send back, like, a list of reasons the study was flawed or something. Like, this is so typical for every imaginable industry, every public health study. But I think Susan helped me. she helped me understand this thing that I understood in my body, but I didn't say it out loud, which is that these are not public health scientists commenting on public health papers. We would not ask an auto mechanic for their medical device or medical advice. So, like, it's just that simple. Like, we can ask them about the implications for a study that says their product is making people sick, but we cannot ask them. I sort of came to realize what they did. How did they get these, like, talking points so quickly? They just simply looked at every scientific study, they'll have, like, here's what we found. Here were our methods. And then they'll be like, here's what we couldn't find because it's, like, impossible to find, you know, address level data on, like, cholesterol or something. They just took the limitations, I guess you would call that the study limitations, and they just, like, repurposed it as, this is why you can't believe the study. So I've stopped asking them their medical advice, essentially.
I want to add to just a quick, which is that you don't have to be the expert. You know, you're the journalist trying to ask the questions, but you don't have to understand, especially if you're doing a story where you're trying to, like, figure out if their climate commitments actually make sense. Like, please don't try to do that math on your own. Like, I could not. But there are a ton of people out there whose job it is who do that. And I think that sometimes what helps is if you need a gut check, you should reach out to a multitude of people and ask them to read it and give you their feedback. You know, let them see if what you're thinking is what they know. And you might get a consensus, which makes you feel really strong. You might get a lot of different perspectives, which then you can definitively say in your reporting, this is questioned amongst experts about the truthfulness. And so you don't have to necessarily just rely on yourself to understand it. You can call for backup. And Emily Holden wants to comment.
I just got too excited about this question. Hi. Years ago, I worked on a story about the Flint water crisis, and a consulting firm that came in like kind of right as everyone was beginning to understand what was happening there. And one of the things that I did first was get in touch with a reporter from the Flint Journal to work with, because I was like, there's no way I'm going to catch up. I don't know what's happening here. This was well after it had happened, but we were looking at documents from long ago. And he just knew absolutely everything about the science. And so I didn't have to know all of that. And that helped so much. But when we had internal documents showing, you know, how this consulting firm, it kind of like helped the city hide how bad it was. And the company, to their credit, they were so responsive. I think the most responsive any company has ever been for an investigation I did. They sent me, I think, 60 or 70 pages, wow, answering every single question, documenting, well, that's not what we meant, and here's what was happening at the time, and here's what we knew, and here's how the water system works, and here's how consulting on water works. And at the end of all of that, after multiple conversations, I said, okay, I'm moving forward with the story. And they said, are you serious? And I said, yeah, it's still a story. I still have the documents that show that you knew what was happening. And they're like, but what about all this other stuff? We need to talk again. We don't think you should run this. You don't have the full picture. You don't have the full picture. And I said, I do have the full picture, right? I did read all of your documents. I have an expert who's helping me understand them. We still see what you did here. We ran the story. They didn't ask for a correction. They didn't bring a legal complaint. And now there is a lawsuit happening there that, as part of this, their internal communications are being unveiled. And it's showing that they hired a crisis communications firm at that time to respond to the story that we were working on. And I don't know for sure, but I imagine that had something to do with the several dozen pages that I received, mm-hmm, explaining everything I could ever possibly want to know, offering to get on the phone with me over and over again. So I just had to keep telling myself, like, this is not in good faith. I know this is not in good faith. It is their job to protect themselves in a situation like this.
I'm Christy George. I work for KUOW Radio in Seattle. And before I'm an editor. Before I was an editor, I was a reporter, and I had a strategy, very gentle, may not work anymore, but to get to know proactively people who might be having an environmental crisis soon and just get to know the Flacks and the, you know, all those people, and create human relationship when there's not a problem. Get a tour of a plant or whatever. Yeah. I've been in a lot of big giant plants. And it does mean they might call you, and they might call you in a pinch, and they might even tell you something. So it's an answer, not a question.
Any other questions? Over here to the left, I see one.
Bobby McGill with Bloomberg. The solar issue keeps coming up. And as I mentioned before, I live in Southern PA, where this is a big issue. You know, there was the discussion in the last session about truth versus facts, and I've found that I don't actually cover solar. I just live there, and I work in D.C. But what it seems is that the facts are sort of beside the point in a lot of these discussions. Reed, you mentioned a minute ago that this is, you know, people just don't want to look at it, and I find that this is sort of like the driving objection to a lot of thing, to a lot of change. It's an emotional argument. And whereas, you know, sure, they try to trot out the stuff about like leaching into the groundwater as sort of a way to justify. So they're using misinformation to justify their emotional response to change. But I'm curious, just from a misinformation standpoint, how you see how we as journalists should address those emotional arguments against change. And, you know, it could be meat consumption. Like, you know, people know that not eating meat or eating less meat is good for the environment. It's a climate solution, but they really just want that barbecue. Mm. I mean, how do you address that as a journalist?
I can take a stab at this one. Yeah, especially with the solar story that I covered, you know, as Reed pointed out, and this is wind power too, obviously, but, you know, there's a bit of NIMBYism that happens with these stories. And so when you cover solar and wind, it's actually really complicated to try to figure out where the opposition is coming from. You know, is it coming from you are afraid of change and you don't want your landscape to look different and you don't want your hometown to look different, which is completely understandable, but one specific perspective. Is it that you're afraid that, like, big data is going to come and use these solar panels and that you're going to have, you know, it's not going to be safe anymore? Is it that you're afraid that you're going to get cancer from leaching? Is it that you're not going to like the humming sound of the windmills or the solar panels in the distance? You know, those are kind of all different perspectives that people have. And I think as reporters, our job is to listen. It's not to necessarily explain. You know, I think that when you're trying to get to the, well, why do you feel this way and where did you get this perspective? And then they bring up, oh, well, I've heard, and then they say something that you know is not factual. I first try to figure out where they got that from, because that often ends up being the story for me. So the story that I covered was actually that most of these individuals that were there were local laws being passed across the Midwest that were trying to ban solar on prime farmland. I did this story with NPR and Floodlight. And I just thought it was so weird. Why do I keep on using this, hearing this word prime? Prime, what is prime farmland? And it turns out that in states like Kansas, like 95% of the state is considered prime farmland. So it's a BS term. It doesn't really mean anything. But the group that was pushing this, it seemed to all be grassroots, and it seemed to be organized through Facebook. It was called Citizens for Responsible Solar. I trace Citizens for Responsible Solar back to Virginia, Northern Virginia, right outside D.C. Turns out the woman who runs the company is from the George W. Bush administration. The guy who runs the board has ties to the Koch brothers, ties to a lot of these GOP groups out of D.C. And they have a vested interest in making sure that green energy does not take off, because the oil and gas industry has a vested interest in that. And so all of that to say is, you know, I think you have to listen to people's feelings, because they are genuine. They might not know where their information is coming from, but they still have those real lived experiences. But when it comes to you as a reporter, it's important to dig deep into what's influencing them to feel that way and question those influences.
Yeah, and I would just add that, like, the more I read, I mean, I don't live in rural America. I live in Miami. But the more I read about rural America, the more Dickensian it seems to me. And, like, a lot of these areas have been subject to generations of extractive cycles of just people sucking the wealth out and moving it somewhere else. And so the NIMBYism that they're expressing, right, about this, it's often very, very genuine. And there's actually a lot of thinking and a lot of feeling and studying going on by the, you know, clean power industry to how to come in and build solar in a way that doesn't look like the way that gas pipelines get built. Very commendable, I imagine, but also, you know, we kind of have to build it quickly, so there's a tension there. And I would absolutely acknowledge that maybe behind the misinformation, there's also probably a lot of pain, right? Like, there's also probably a lot of lived experience of having your area sort of be a sacrifice zone for this whole thing, which is very different from, like, my parents freaking out because they're going to have a pickleball court in front of their condo in Miami.
It's sacrifice.
Oh, my God, 70 decibels when somebody pocks it, right? Which, misinfo, not 70.
All right. Reed, did you have one final comment before we wrap?
The solar thing is interesting. This is a little side note, but, like, a lot of these people have just seen a couple decades of the natural gas industry come through, buying up leases, buying up land, you know, neighbor against neighbor, that whole story that we've all read about. And now a new industry is coming in, often with the exact same land men or land women. Mm-hmm. Same people are now coming in for solar. And so it's like, if I would expect people to be skeptical. And all this misinformation is just like, they're already teetering. It's just like a domino. I mean, it's like so that's all.
All right. Well, thank you guys all for listening in on our panel. I think we're going to take a quick 10-ish minute coffee and bathroom break and then come back and start lightning talks.
Oh, wait.
And I guess we need some restocking of coffee.
Hold on, I'm just a logistical thing. If you're doing a lightning talk, when you come back in, sit at this table. If you're not doing a lightning talk, don't sit at that table. Thank you.
Rita, I wanted to ask you, I read this book. It's actually about your area, and it mentions range resources called Amity and Prosperity.
Such a great job. Both of you guys.
Good job,
great questions. Yeah. Thanks. That was fun. I wish you could talk more with them.
Yeah, it's fun.
I love doing like these round tables. Yeah.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi.